The final installment of Edmund Morris's three-volume biography of Theodore Roosevelt is about the final decade of the great man's life. It begins far from Washington on an African safari and ends on the north shore of Long Island. Colonel Roosevelt is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings Edmund Morris back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you, Leonard.
And why Colonel Roosevelt? He was a former president. Wouldn't he have been President Roosevelt?
Well, he was asked that question when he came out of the White House in 1909. He was asked what he would like to be called, and he said that he felt that the title of president was finite, that it went with the job, and when the job was given back to the American people, a man should revert to whatever title he preferred. So since he had been a bona fide military hero in 1898 in the Spanish-American War, had been colonel of his regiment, he figured he had that title for life, and that's what he wanted to be called.
Interestingly, Dwight D. Eisenhower asked to be called General Eisenhower after he left the White House.
Probably for the same reason. He felt he'd earned the title and he wanted to keep it.
The first book in this trilogy, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award after it was released in 1979. So you've been writing about Roosevelt for a little over 40 years. Did you know what you were getting into when you started?
Well, it's 30 years altogether, but I did do a biography of Ronald Reagan, which took me 15 of those 30.
Was that a bit of a respite? Were you getting over TR'd at the time?
Yes, I was, yeah. I've tried to follow each of the volumes on TR with something different. I followed Volume 2 with a biography of Beethoven that took me a year and a half to write. So altogether, I've spent about 5 years on each of the three books.
And Beethoven is a non-political figure. What led you to him?
Well, I'm not interested in politics. I was not led to write about TR or, for that matter, about Ronald Reagan for political reasons. I just found their characters fascinating and their life stories even more so.
Is it just a coincidence that you begin this book in Africa, where you are from?
It's a happy coincidence that he went there within 3 weeks of leaving the White House in 1909 on a marathon safari in behalf of the Smithsonian Institution. But the mere fact that he was there in the country I was born in and grew up in made that prologue to Colonel Roosevelt a luxury to write.
Well, you were born in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
He went to a number of British colonies, but schooled in South Africa during the heyday of apartheid, weren't you? Were you taught about the American presidents during those years?
I was schooled in Kenya. I grew up there and went to school. I went to university briefly in South Africa. And you're right, I didn't have much education in the American history or American way of life, except what I acquired through reading the Saturday Evening Post as a boy in the United States Information Service in Nairobi.
What led Theodore Roosevelt to go to Africa so soon after he left the White House? He went with his son Kermit.
He did. It was a scientific expedition for the Smithsonian, but it was also a political gesture because he was aware that his gigantic personality and his hold on the American popular imagination would make things difficult for President Taft, his hand-picked successor, if he stayed stateside. So he deliberately, and I think very honorably, absented himself from the American scene for more than a year, 1909, 1910, to give Taft a chance to carve out a political profile for himself.
Which Taft did, and later disappointed Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah, he turned out to be much more conservative than TR had expected.
How?
And also not a particularly efficient presidential executive.
How much in touch was Roosevelt during this safari with what was going on back home? I mean, it isn't like today where you can just open up your computer and find out what's happening anywhere in the world.
Quite true. Maybe on three occasions in that year he was in the wilderness, a messenger would show up with this or that letter from the United States, but effectively he had absolutely no knowledge of what was going on, not only in America, but in the outside world.
Wasn't Andrew Carnegie involved in paying for this safari?
Yes, he largely financed it.
What, did he have any ulterior motives? He just wanted to do a favor to Theodore Roosevelt?
Well, Carnegie is one of these little rich gray guys who likes to attach himself to figures of power and tries to become part of the councils of power. His motive, I think, in giving TR all that money was the hope that after the expedition, TR would involve himself in the international peace movement, which Carnegie was passionate about, and involve Carnegie personally in international councils.
Well, Carnegie was a man who, on the one hand, was a robber baron. On the other hand, was very involved with doing good. He gave us Carnegie Hall. He gave America many great libraries. He's an interesting figure, too. But like T.R., a man of great contradictions.
Yes, he was not somebody who T.R. was particularly comfortable with. T.R. never liked tycoons, but he liked their money when it served his scientific or political purposes. But he very much resented these people trying to influence him as a statesman.
He was that rare Republican who didn't like tycoons?
Yes, indeed. In fact, if he was alive today and practicing, he would without question be a Democrat.
While they were on safari, Roosevelt killed what would strike most modern readers who are not members of the NRA as an incredible number of animals, what he calls specimens, 9 lions, 13 rhinos, 7 hippos, 20 zebras. That's a major killing.
It is. He killed, I think, about 270, 280 specimens during the course of the safari, but it was within quota, and it was for the Smithsonian Museum.
To be shipped back to the United States?
Yeah.
In fact, I believe
some of the crates from that expedition have still not been opened. But when you compare that kind of tally with the Emperor of Austria, who killed 50,000 animals in his lifetime, it's small potatoes.
Did T.R. flourish in the African wilderness?
Yeah, I think he reached his peak of physical virility and strength and exuberance in the African wilderness.
Well, how old was he at the time?
Well, he was only 50 when he left the White House, youngest president we've ever had. And in Africa, he mushroomed physically and reached a state of superb health. But the story of the rest of his life is rather less virile. He gradually deteriorated and had several near-death experiences, an assassination attempt, delirium and fever on the River of Dart in Brazil, and the general declivities of old age.
Well, he had contracted malaria when he was in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Was there no fear that it might not flare up when he went to Africa?
It did. It did several times. On the whole, he was in superb condition in Africa, but his attacks of malaria, or Cuban fever, as he called it.
He'd also gone to Panama during the building of the canal, and malaria was a serious problem there as well.
Yellow fever, right. But the United States more or less eradicated it there. But these attacks of fever grew more frequent in his later years, and they contributed to his death at the early age of 60 in 1919.
Did his experience in Africa have an effect on his political viewpoint?
No, I don't think so. He saw British colonialism in action, didn't much like everything that he saw. And in a lecture which I reproduce in the course of the prologue to this book, he, in the Nairobi Club, lectured the British colonists on their policies of racial intolerance and said that a policy of cruel suppression of the black men in Africa was incompatible with democracy.
But hadn't T.R. been involved with American imperialism? He was involved with the Spanish-American War. He pretty much forced Colombia to give us – was it Colombia or Venezuela to give us the Panama Zone?
Colombia, yes.
He did any number of things that today – and his opening up of China was really more – an imperialist venture than it was an economic one. It seems to me that he might not have been the best person to lecture the British about that sort of thing.
Well, if you conflate all these various incidents and episodes from his life all together, it can create a confusing picture. He was without question an imperialist when he was young and when he was fighting the Spanish-American War. But when he became president, he quickly became much less so. He became much more of a statesman. The size of the United States with its territorial possessions diminished during his presidency. He couldn't wait to give Cuba its independence, for example, in 1902. And he achieved a level of international statesmanship as the mediator of the Russo-Japanese War, which was anything but imperialistic, which is not to say that he wasn't typical of his class and time. He believed that the Anglo-Saxon race, as he called it, was a superior race. He believed commensurately that the Japanese race, in quotes, was equal to the Anglo-Saxon, but he was not all that crazy about the American Indian or, for that matter, the mass of African blacks.
But here he is in Africa. What does he think about the black people he's meeting there?
Well, as I mentioned, at the Nairobi Club, he made a strong and impassioned appeal to the Brits not to regard them as a lower species and to treat them with cruelty. But his own personal attitude toward them was kindly but patronizing.
How long did he stay in Africa?
He was there for more than a year.
Well, he wasn't on safari all that time.
Yes, he was. Yeah, the safari lasted a full year, and when he came out of Africa, he came down the Nile in the spring of 1910, he found a batch of invitations to visit all the royal courts of Europe from kings and emperors who believed that he was going to go back to the United States and run for the presidency again. So he embarked on a great grand tour of Europe and emerged as probably the most famous man in the world in the middle part of 1910.
What led those European leaders to think he was going to run for president again? Was he dropping any hints?
No, but they realized that the Republican Party needed strong leadership, and they could see that he was still young, diplomatically well-connected. I'm talking about Tiana, full of political power and potential. And they just sensed that since there were no constitutional restraints on the number of times a man could run and be president, they sensed that he would go back and reclaim his inheritance.
My guest is Edmund Morris, who has completed his 3-volume biography of Theodore Roosevelt, this one, Colonel Roosevelt. It is published by Random House. So there he is in Europe, and one thing that seems to come up again and again is his prescience about the possibility of a war in Europe. How did he navigate the delicate channels between Germany and Great Britain?
With a considerable amount of skill, he was a very subtle diplomatist. And you're quite right, he could see the war coming, he could feel it. And for that matter, so could all these potentates that he stayed with in their palaces. They all knew a catastrophe was coming. But when he was viewing the German army in its maneuvers at Döberitz in May of 1910, with the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, at his side, he saw totalitarian, mechanized warfare in its embryo state. He could see it coming, and it depressed him deeply.
Didn't Wilhelm II see T.R. as a kindred spirit, but T.R. didn't see Wilhelm that way?
No, there were superficial similarities. They were both vigorous, forthright personalities, muscular and full of aggression. But T.R. was sophisticated, feline, full of knowledge, whereas Wilhelm was comparatively uneducated and very narcissistic.
What did he envision that he'd be doing after he returned to the United States?
He wanted to live a life of quiet literary retirement. He wanted to write more books toward his lifetime total of 40. He wanted to be contributing editor of the Outlook magazine, which was a serious quarterly periodical at that time. He wanted to write essays, and also he wanted to renew his acquaintance with his 6 children, whom he adored.
Didn't he also aspire to sit on the Supreme Court?
No. No, T.R. was not judicial by temperament, and he certainly did not have that aspiration.
Although his successor, Taft, did wind up on the court, which is kind of odd, isn't it? The only president who wound up sitting on the Supreme Court?
Yeah. Charles Evans Hughes nearly became president in 1916, and he also ended up being Chief Justice.
So he's been away from his wife and his eldest daughter, Alice, who's a rather formidable figure. Did he miss them at all? Was this a problem?
He didn't miss them, but he was aware of the fact that having been president for two full terms and having spent a year in Africa, he'd been separated from all his children with the exception of Kermit, who went on the safari with him. And since they were beginning to grow up and mature and become interesting personalities in their own right, he wanted to become close to them again as he had been before he was president.
They seemed to see a change in him.
Everybody saw a change in him when he came back. He had this extraordinary reception by the citizens of New York in June of 1910, the greatest reception, welcome back, that any American had received up until the time of Lindbergh in the late 20s. And everybody noticed how much larger he seemed to have grown during his year in the wilderness. And as a result of this grand tour of Europe, when he walked on equal terms, if not superior terms, with all those kings and potentates. So he came back a major international statesman and a seeming certain future president of the United States.
Did Taft immediately see that as a threat to his position?
Yes, and I think T.R. also, within a few weeks, began to realize that Taft was contradicting and perverting his presidential record.
We have a clip of T.R. talking about how Taft was handling big business, and I'd like to play that.
There are too many who do not prosper enough, and of the few who prosper greatly, there are certainly some whose prosperity does not mean welfare for the country. Rational progressives, no matter how radical, are well aware that nothing the government can do will make some men prosper, and we heartily approve the prosperity, no matter how great, of any man if it comes because of his rendering service to the community.
It's an extraordinary voice, isn't it? You can hear every syllable being chopped up by all those teeth.
Mm. But he's lecturing big business about their role in America. Did he feel Taft was just too cozy with it?
Yes, he felt Taft was a spokesman for the corporate interests. Too cozy with Wall Street, too cozy with corporate leaders, played too much golf. T.R. himself had a patrician attitude toward wealth. He believed that if a man was born rich, as he had been, inherited wealth, that he had to pay back for his good fortune with public service and democratic behavior. His passion as president in his first term was the regulatory control of corporations and the corporate class. And that became even stronger a motivation for his desire to return to the presidency in 1912.
Well, you said that if he were alive today, you think he would have been a Democrat. Why couldn't he have just switched over to the Democratic Party at that time instead of creating his own party?
Because the Democratic Party at that time was totally different from, well, not entirely totally, but was much different from what it is now. It was strongly racist.
And Woodrow Wilson was personally a racist.
Oh, yes. The first thing he did when he became president was eliminate every black man in the federal government. And the Democratic Party also was very cozy with the gold Democrats on Wall Street. So it would have been quite against T.R.'s nature in those days to have joined that party.
So he helped create a grassroots party, or the grassroots party was created and then T.R. Became its figurehead in the way that Sarah Palin or Ron Paul might be considered the ideal candidates for the current Tea Party movement?
Yes, there are parallels between the progressives in 100 years ago and the Tea Party movement now. I wouldn't stress them too much because the Progressive Party that coalesced around TR were mainly white, middle-class, small-town Republicans who felt excluded from the cozy establishmentarian arrangement in Washington of a conservative Congress and a conservative White House and compliant Wall Street. They felt disenfranchised, they wanted power, and they had a great deal of passion, and they wanted him in particular in 1910 and 1912 to emerge as their spokesman and run for president in their behalf.
How did he position himself in regard to Taft and to Wilson?
At first, with Taft, he tried to get the Republican nomination in 1912 by legitimate means. He ran against the sitting president, and it was only when the orthodox machinery of the party prevented him getting the nomination, despite an enormous primary popular vote in his favor, that he decided to bolt the Republican Party and form the Progressive Party with a capital P. And by doing so, of course, he divided the Republican establishment and more or less guaranteed the election of Woodrow Wilson as the minority Democratic candidate in 1912.
And you mentioned an attempt on his life while he was campaigning?
Yes, at the climax of his campaign in October of 1912, he was to deliver a speech after dinner in Milwaukee and emerging from his hotel in circumstances uncannily like the attack on Ronald Reagan in March of 1981, he climbed into his limousine and got hit in the chest. by a bullet fired by this short, blonde, dull-eyed young man, John Schrank, and the bullet happily hit a series of impediments. His steel spectacle case, his folded-over speech, hit a rib, but if it had gone on in its trajectory, it would have killed him before he sat down.
He actually wound up giving a speech before he went to the hospital.
Well, there's the complete showman for you. He marched out in front of that audience with blood spreading across his shirt front, and he said, "It takes more than that to kill a bull moose," and spoke for 90 minutes before he allowed them to take him to hospital.
And what was the reason that the assassin tried to kill him?
It was a complex of paranoid and logical motives. The paranoia was similar to the paranoia of most presidential assassins, but his specific reason, he said, was that T.R. was perverting American political tradition by running for a third term, and he felt that that should be stopped with a bullet.
He didn't know that there'd be another Roosevelt who would run for a third and a fourth.
And he lived on into FDR's time. And when FDR ran for a third term, in jail, John Schrank became noticeably unstable again and threatening FDR.
In the election, where did T.R. come in?
He came in a very strong second, beat a humiliated President Taft, but as I said, because he divided the vote, Woodrow Wilson was elected president.
And then he decided to go on an expedition to South America.
Mm-hmm.
The same sort of thing he did after he left the White House, only in this case South America. He was not as strong as he was when he went to Africa. What was the goal of the expedition in South America?
Originally, he wanted to go to South America just for scientific reasons, to lead an expedition up the Tapajós River. But the Brazilian government prevailed on him to accept financing and to lead a joint Brazilian-American expedition in search of an unknown river, which they suspected was a tributary of the Amazon. And that river, the Rio da Dúvida, the River of Doubt, was almost T.R.'s deathbed, because in the course of exploring it, it was almost 1,000 miles long. He came very near death through a combination of abscesses and fever and heart trouble.
Did his malaria flare up again?
Yes, it did, yeah. He lay at the point of death in the lower stretches of the river, which was subsequently renamed in honor of him as the Rio Roosevelt.
So was this the beginning of the deterioration that continued until he died rather young?
Yeah. From then on, it was pretty well inexorable. Although he lived to the age of 60, which sounds young to us now, he was manifestly an old man by the time his 60th birthday came around.
Was there ever talk of him running for president again?
Oh, there was, yeah. In fact, after he died on January the 6th of 1919, it was generally accepted that if he'd lived another year, he would have been nominated for president by the Republican Party again, and without question, he would have been elected that year in the Republican landslide that gave us Warren Harding.
There's no doubt he would have been a better president than Warren Harding. He was a strong supporter of the war, World War One. Yet he was opposed to Woodrow Wilson. Weren't the Republicans talking about staying out of the war?
At first, he supported Woodrow Wilson's policy of neutrality to World War One. But three things happened which offended his civilized instincts. There was the sacking of the University of Louvain in Belgium by the Germans. The greatest medieval manuscript library in Europe was deliberately burned by these barbarians, as he called them. Then they destroyed the Cathedral of Reims, and T.R. likened that to the extermination of a great species. And then they sank the Lusitania by submarine action in May of 1915, killing many Americans aboard. And those three acts convinced T.R. that the rise of German militarism was inimical to Western democracy and that the United States had to get in to support democracy and support France and Britain in Europe.
And he died on Long Island at just around 60 years old.
Mm-hmm. After his 60th birthday.
Now, I'm assuming that because you were playing some music before you came in here, that your next project will again be, it will involve music. Is that true?
I wouldn't mind writing about another musician or perhaps an artist.
Where do you go after Beethoven?
Well, you're right. Franz Liszt interests me a lot, I can tell you, because his character was equally fascinating and paradoxical. But I haven't quite decided what I'm going to do next.
Meanwhile, we have this book, the last volume in the three-volume biography of Theodore Roosevelt, this one called Colonel Roosevelt. It is published by Random House. And my great thanks to Edmund Morris for being with us again to talk about it.
Thank you, Leonard.